Hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Our program today is the hidden history of American oligarchy, and we have a very special guest today who will talk about his book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. This is his latest book in his Hidden History series, which raises the alarm that billionaire oligarchs want to own our republic, and that they are close to doing so due to several decades of legislation and Supreme Court decisions. And whom am I speaking of? Just the most popular progressive national and internationally syndicated talk show host and a four-time recipient of the Project Censored Award and also a New York Times bestselling author of 26 books, Tom Hartman. Welcome to Be Bold America, Tom. I am super honored to be speaking with you today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jill. It's great to talk to you, too.
And it's a pleasure for me personally and for our listeners on the California Central Coast. And before we jump into our topic, I wanted to thank you, Tom, on behalf of KSQD for your support in allowing us to air your show. Since KSQD first went on the air 2 years ago, your show is heard every weekday at 4 p.m., and KSQD is the only radio station in the area playing your amazing program. We're very proud of that. So again, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
For hearing the show.
We love it here. To kick off, Tom, would you please just begin defining who are the oligarchy and why is it important that we know who they are and what they want?
Well, oligarchy is a form of government, broadly speaking, that could be described as rule by the rich. The book that came just prior to this, The Hidden History of American Monopoly. Monopoly was about how economic power has become concentrated in a relative small number of hands in the United States, resulting in the average American family spending about $5,000 a year more than a similar family in Europe, for example, would do, where they still enforce the competition laws for everything from internet to cell phones to airplanes to, I mean, you name it. That concentration of wealth in a monopoly, or a parallel to that, when it's a concentration of political power among wealthy people, is what you would call an oligarchy. And while we don't pay an oligarchy tax so much, although I think you could argue that we do because, you know, taxes on working people tend to go up and taxes on the rich go down during these times, we do pay a price in terms of the function of our democracy, which is badly compromised by this.
Well, you talk about the two unsuccessful oligarchies in American history, and that today we're battling a third, who have pretty successfully pushing our nation closer to tyranny. This isn't a new battle for us, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, our country was founded in a battle against oligarchy and monopoly, and that was, of course, the American Revolution. But the first significant rise of oligarchy in the United States post-revolution happened in the 1820s. The process began in the 1820s, and it came to a head in 1861 with the initiation of the Civil War. And that was, interestingly, it was the result of an invention, a technological advance. It's surprising how often cultures and societies and economies get just radically changed as a consequence of, you know, what seem to be almost insignificant technological advances. In 1798, Eli Whitney invented a machine that would clean the seeds out of a bowl of cotton. When you pick they're called bowls, B-O-L-L, but it's a little, you know, fist-sized lump of cotton. When you pick that off the cotton plant, it has permeated through it these black seeds that have the fibers running through them and attached to them, and it's really hard to get those seeds out. And the cotton gin, it was a giant drum with screen around the outside and these little hooks that went through the screens and would pull the cotton out, but the screen was too small for the seeds to come through. And one cotton gin could clean, and cleaning the cotton was the big bottleneck in the production of cotton. because it took so many people to clean the cotton compared to how many people it took to pick it or to prepare it for shipping. And so one cotton gin could do the work of 50 enslaved people. And so what happened was the larger plantations in the South that had the resources to buy a cotton gin, and even though the invention was in the late 1700s, it really wasn't until the early 1800s, around 1810, that it really came to market. Those plantations were able to buy cotton gins, and they got so much more efficient at producing cotton that they could underbid all of the smaller cotton farms around them and economically wipe them out, which they did over a 30-year period from basically 1815 to around 1840, 1845. And what you ended up with in the Cotton Belt was just a system of, it was an oligarchy, very wealthy planters, plantation owners who, were using the cotton gin to create absolute economic dominance. And then those people started getting upset with the bankers in New York and the wholesalers and everything else, and they just wanted the whole thing. And that's when they declared war on the United States. And, of course, it was as much over slavery as it was over economics. But that oligarchy was largely crushed. We broke up the plantations. In fact, Robert E. Lee's plantation was turned into what today we call Arlington National Cemetery. And although some of the other, like Parchman, that big plantation down in, I believe it's Louisiana, is now a state prison. And they continue to grow cotton because the 13th Amendment didn't actually end slavery. It simply said that slavery is legal in the United States if a person has been convicted of a crime. And so we still practice that. But that was the first time. The second time was the result of the technological innovations of the Industrial Revolution in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, the rise of railroads, steel, coal, oil, the internal combustion engine, the diesel engine in particular in the 1870s, and then the gasoline engine there were first alcohol engines in the 1880s. And that oligarchy, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the Morgans and the Astors and, all these different industrial sectors, banking, chemicals, dynamite, railroads, those oligarchs rose up. Teddy Roosevelt tried to take a bite out of them in the early 1900s, in the first decade, but wasn't particularly successful. And in that, other than passing a couple of laws that were good reforms, but they crashed the market in 1929. They're just absolutely insane greed, and that gave Franklin Roosevelt an opportunity to essentially go to war with them. In fact, he said, "They hate me, and I welcome their hatred." And that was, and they fought back. They decided that they were going. There was a veterans organization that was very right wing, and they recruited over 100,000 members of that organization to storm the White House and physically seize Franklin Roosevelt. And haul him off and set up a new presidency, a new government, and that scheme failed when they approached the most famous military official in at that point in time in America, a fellow by the name of Smedley Butler. He's a Marine general, and had been a big hero of World War I and before that of the Spanish American War, and when they approached Butler and said, assuming that he was a right winger, and said, we're going to take down Franklin Roosevelt, we're going to overthrow the government, and we're going to make this government oligarch friendly again, Smedley Butler blew the whistle on them. And so that, it was called the businessman's revolt, or conspiracy, actually, was the word that was used back then. And that, Roosevelt, broke them up and taxed them, raised the top tax rate, top tax bracket to 91%, and, put them in a bottle until the 1970s. And now we're in the third phase of oligarchy, which really started around 1976.
Well, I also learned in reading your book, the Confederacy rose up not to simply preserve Southern oligarchy, but to extend it to the rest of the United States.
Yeah.
I think, is this third time in an effort to do that extending?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, each time the oligarchs have risen up, they've tried to take control of the entire country. And, of course, this is what we saw, you know, on the political stage on January 6th. And, you know, we're starting to get a sense now. We know that there are a couple of billionaires who heavily funded that event, or at least some pieces of that event. And of course, we had a billionaire as a president at that time, an oligarch. And but this modern incarnation of oligarchy really started in 1976. When Nixon went down in flames in 1974, not so much as a consequence of Watergate, but as a result of the Nixon bribery scandals. As Watergate was coming out, we also learned that Nixon had taken $1 million bribe from Jimmy Hoffa to get him out of jail in the Sun Valley land deal. He had taken $500,000 bribe from the milk lobby. There were suggestions that others, perhaps a soft drink company, had bribed him to help open their way to China, and others. And as a consequence of those Nixon bribery scandals in 1974, in late 1974 and 1975, with Republican President Jerry Ford at the helm, Congress passed and the president signed a number of good government laws that limited the ability of wealthy people to influence politics, that more heavily criminalized the money in politics that was used essentially as bribes. It was a good thing. It was a really good start. But in 1971, a fellow by the name of Lewis Powell had, at the request of Eugene Sindor, his friend, neighbor, and the I don't recall if his title was chairman or president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, had asked him to write a document about how the business community could go about recovering the political power that they had had back in the 1920s, you know, before FDR. And Powell wrote this memo, laid it out, said, you know, we need to seize the courts, we need to take control of the colleges. The wealthy people should be funding economics and political science chairs and departments. We need to take control of the media. Billionaires should be buying networks of radio stations and television stations and newspapers. We need to take control of the public schools, and the textbooks. It was just a massive sweeping document, the Powell memo. And in 1972, Nixon had put him on the U.S. Supreme Court. So in 1976, in a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time in the history of the United States that if an individual billionaire, of course, back then it would be the equivalent of a billion in today's money. It was hundreds of millions back then. But if an individual billionaire were to be such a patron to an individual politician that they were the principal source of support for that politician, and that politician's principal activity was to pass legislation beneficial to that particular billionaire, we used to call that bribery or, at the very least, political corruption. But the Supreme Court ruled in 1976 in the Buckley versus Vallejo case that that was, in fact, neither, and that the money was not actually money, that the money was actually speech, and that giving that money to politicians, wealthy people giving money to politicians, was protected by the First Amendment's free speech provision. 2 years later, in a decision that was actually written by Lewis Powell, First National Bank versus Bilotti, they extended that logic to corporations and said, well, you know, corporations can do the same thing. And what happened was those two decisions just opened a wave of money, just a tsunami of money. And most all of it flowed into the Republican Party, because at that point in time, in the late 70s, the Democratic Party was almost entirely funded through working class people via their labor unions. And in fact, the unions were so prosperous. I mean, a third of America, you know, had union jobs. Unions were so prosperous and so awash in cash that Jimmy Hoffa could skim off $1 million to bribe Richard Nixon. So the Democrats didn't pay much attention to those two decisions, but the Republicans said, oh, boy, we'll take your money. And on this tsunami of cash, Ronald Reagan rode into the White House in 1980, and in 81 set about really radically changing our corporate governance laws and just a whole variety of things. The Supreme Court then doubled down on Buckley and First National Bank versus Bilotti in 2010 with Citizens United.
Right.
In 2013, in a case called McCutcheon, they ruled that the previous limit of, I think it was 130 politicians that an individual billionaire could own, that limit just goes away. You can own an unlimited number of politicians. And so now, basically, the entire Republican Party is owned by a relatively small number of oligarchs and industries. But the other half of that with regard to the Democratic Party was that one of the first things Reagan did in 81 was he said, we have to break the back of the Democratic Party. We have to defund the Democratic Party, and most of their money is coming from unions, so we have to destroy the unions. And that was the principal mission of his administration, and he did it. He cut union membership in half during the Reagan and Bush administration, just those 12 years, so that when Bill Clinton in 92 was running for president, he couldn't get enough money from the unions to run a presidential campaign, and he had to go hat in hand to the big banks and the insurance companies. And he and Al Fromm created the DLC specifically to funnel corporate cash into the Democratic Party. That is changing now in the Democratic Party, now that they've discovered, you know, with the Sanders and the Biden and the ultimately the Obama presidential runs, that they can still have the working class people pay for a presidential election. We're just doing it online now, but that's kind of where we're at. You know, the oligarchs have taken over.
So whoever has the most money has the most free speech. We're listening Tom Hartman, and you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online from KSQD.org homepage, and listen to Tom Hartman right here weekdays at 4 p.m. And learn more about Tom, all his writings, and his radio program. Visit his website, TomHartman.com. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Tom Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Tom Hartman, who Talkers Magazine named as America's most important progressive host and has named his show one of the top 10 radio shows in the country. We're talking about his new book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. That's out this week and may be purchased wherever fine books are sold. Now, Tom, one thing is we talked about, oligarchy and the corporations and what the Supreme Court has done. And how did corporations get to have the same rights as living, breathing people? Since we share Santa Clara County as a neighbor of ours, I think listeners would like to hear how this happened.
Yeah, well, Santa Clara County played a big,
yes.
big role in that. Back in 1886, the railroad oligarchs, principally Gould and oh, I'm forgetting the other guy's name. Sanderson was their lawyer, but anyhow, they wanted to have constitutional protections for their corporations. The big gripe that the Southern Pacific Railroad had was that in Santa Ana County they were paying a half a cent per mile property tax on their railroad lines. And in Santa Clara County, they were paying a penny a mile. And so they argued that the 14th Amendment, which requires equal protection under the law, that they were being treated unequally. They had unequal protection because they were paying two different tax rates in two different counties. And so the backstory of this is that these railroad oligarchs had been had bribed Stephen Jay Field, who was one of the Supreme Court justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Field, back in those days, the Supreme Court justices were in Washington, D.C. 3 months out of the year, and then 9 months out of the year, they did what was called riding the circuit. They were both the chief circuit court judges and on the Supreme Court. And so for 9 months out of the year, Stephen Field came back to California, and he would run the Ninth Circuit. And I was the guy who discovered these papers. We actually found this in Stephen Field's papers in the National Archive, the letters offering him the bribe that the railroad companies said, we will sponsor you to run for president in the next election. I think that would have been 1892, was what they were talking about, if you will get us, if you'll help us win this case. And so Field sent a series. There were seven of them altogether, five of them fairly substantial. They were referred to as the railroad tax cases in aggregate, and they were all within about a three-year period, where in every one of those cases in the Ninth Circuit, in the California Circuit Court, he ruled that the railroad corporations, because they had rights as persons, were entitled to 14th Amendment protection, and basically struck down Santa Clara County's the higher tax. And then, of course, the railroad, the county appealed, and it got thrown to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this one particular case was argued in the Supreme Court by Dolphin Delmas, who was a relatively famous lawyer at that time. He was the guy who, on a pro bono basis for free, he argued this case for free also. He saved the Redwoods in California, which is a whole other story, but just a remarkable fellow. And he went into the Supreme Court against Robert Sanderson, who was the lawyer for the railroads, and said, this is crazy, this doctrine. The railroad's argument was that a corporation, that there's two kinds of persons, and this is long established common law that goes back 500 years or more, that there's a natural person, which is like, you and me, Jill, and then there's a corporate, and then there's what's called an artificial person, and that would be a church or a corporation or even a city, any kind of incorporation. And the reason why it's called an artificial person, the reason why it has some personhood, is because it has to have some status under the law in order to be able to sue, to be sued, to pay taxes, to be regulated. There has to be an entity there that's real. And so the idea of corporate personhood was well established, but nobody had ever suggested that corporations should have constitutional rights. But Sanderson's argument before the Supreme Court was that the 14th Amendment does not say equal protection shall be provided to all natural persons. It simply says all persons. And he said, we are persons too. Now, in that case, weirdly enough, the Supreme Court ruled against the railroads. They lost the case. John Chandler Bancroft Davis, who was a former railroad president himself, he was the son of the governor of Massachusetts and one of the wealthier East Coast elites at the time. He was the clerk of the court. The clerk of the court back in those days, because he ran the court 12 months a year, actually had more power than any of the individual justices, and he got a higher salary, he had more influence, he was feted in high society and all this kind of stuff. And he wrote a headnote, which has no legal standing. It's not part of the decision. It's a commentary that is attached to a Supreme Court decision so that clerks and law students can easily find things. He wrote this headnote in which he said that the Chief Justice of the court, Morrison Renwick Waite, had actually said out loud during the proceedings that, you know, nobody's disputing that corporations are persons. Well, Wade actually had said that, but he was talking about artificial persons. I mean, he was actually making a sarcastic remark, like, you know, come on, nobody's arguing that these corporations aren't artificial persons and don't have the right to sue. But, you know, really? First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, Fifth Amendment rights, 14th Amendment rights? You want to do that? The way that John Chandler Bancroft Davis wrote this in the head note, and you can read it, I mean, it's public knowledge, made it sound like Chief Justice Wade had actually endorsed the idea of corporate personhood being constitutionally similar to human personhood. Now, that had no legal authority. Wade died the next year. He was in congestive heart failure at the time of the hearing of this case, and he died shortly thereafter. And so he never had a chance to rebut it. It turns out that there were three of the seven justices at that time who had been bribed by the railroads. But they still, you know, the court never ruled that corporations should have rights under the Constitution. But once that was in that head note, about a decade later, the Supreme Court quoted the head note, and then it became actually a precedent. I mean, the Supreme Court can quote Daffy Duck if they want. Once they do it, that's the new law. And so corporations became people, my friend.
Well, it was just stunning that a head note has had this kind of life in our country and affected us so much. You also had in the book a fairly lengthy quote that President Grover Cleveland had said, and just to read the last sentence was, "Corporations which should be carefully restrained creatures of the law and the servants of the people are fast becoming the people's masters." Has that been completed, Tom? Are corporations now our masters?
Well, yeah, and that was the next year. That was 1887, wasn't it? As I recall, I don't have the book in front of me here. I'm doing all this from memory.
I think so.
Yeah, it was either the next year, that year, or the year after. And that was in his State of the Union address as President of the United States. So the evidence of this comes from a study done by Gillens and Page, two researchers, Matthew Gillens. I'm sorry, I don't remember Page's first name. One's with Northwestern, the other was with
Benjamin?
Princeton.
Benjamin.
Yeah, Benjamin Page, yeah. And it was published, I think, under the name of Columbia. You may have it right there in the book in front of you.
And Northwestern. Princeton and Northwestern.
Northwestern, thank you. What they found was that if you went back prior to the Reagan administration, or prior to the early 1990s, really, when Reaganism had really cemented itself in the American landscape, that generally speaking, what the majority of people wanted is what got made into law. People liked Social Security. They expanded Social Security. People wanted unions. They gave them unions. People want, you know, whatever it may be. They wanted housing. They gave them housing. They wanted civil rights. They got civil rights. But post-Reagan, what they found was that the ability of the average person, you know, the policy positions that average people wanted, measured by public opinion polls, were just no longer being made into law. Instead, what was being made into law were the things that the top, you know, 1-5% wanted. And in fact, they concluded that the probability, kind of basically post 2000, of anything being made into law that the majority of Americans wanted was roughly equivalent to random noise. It was just, you know, unmeasurable, that you couldn't find a correlation. That's a clear indication that you have moved out of democracy and into oligarchy. And that study is relatively famous. It's been quoted a lot. It's been replicated. It's why, I mean, for example, you got over 80% of America thinks that college should be free. Over 80% of America thinks that healthcare should be a right, depending on how you phrase the question. And yet these are controversial left-wing issues, right? Well over 75% of America. Well, actually, there was an opinion survey yesterday I saw on CNN that was in the 80s again. People saying that there should be a massive stimulus to help people who are unemployed. And still, you've got an entire political party, the Republicans, who are saying, no, no way. And now Susan Collins is leading a charge to gut the $1.9 trillion bill, which is still only two-thirds the size of what the House of Representatives passed back in June, which Mitch McConnell refused to ever even allow a debate on in the Senate. That was a $3 trillion program, the CARES Act, or the HEROES Act, rather. And so, you know, that's where we're at now. We've got the oligarchs running the Republican Party, although they're having their own problems right now, and which often happens because oligarchy is essentially an unstable form of government if it's not accompanied by a rigorous police state, like you see in Russia. And even there, it's destabilized now. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Our topic is the hidden history of American oligarchy, and we're speaking with Tom Hartman. Become a Tom Hartman patron on Patreon to see his special videos only made for his supporters. Being a patron helps Tom continue to provide his program at no cost to community radio stations like KSQD 90.7 FM. So become a Tom Hartman patron and support both him and KSQD. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
What do you give a radio station for its second birthday? Well, could sing happy birthday to us, or you could tell us about a driveway moment you had listening to K-Squid, some particular piece of radio that just moved you, or a song you heard, or anything at all you want to say about the importance of K-Squid in your life. Give us a call at 831-900-5773 and leave a voicemail, and we'll put it on the air through the month of February. Again, that's 831-900-5773. Think about what you want to say and call us on our Squid line. And thank you.
Now, back to our bold and impressive guest, Tom Hartman, who is a New York Times bestselling author of 26 books. We're speaking with him about his latest book coming out this week, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. Now, Tom, how many people are we actually talking about? You know, we're talking about the oligarchy, and it sounds like this big block of lots of people. But is it really a lot of people, or is it just a small group compared to the population of this country?
Oh, there are probably, I don't know that anybody's done a survey of that, and that's a great question, Jill.
Thank you.
You know, we know of some of the big donors, you know, Shelley Adelson, who recently died, and Charles Koch and his brother David, who's passed away now. You know, what's the name of the family that funded the Trump campaign, the Mercers?
The Mercers, and there's the Waltons.
Yeah, and the Waltons. I mean, you know, there's probably 20 or 30 billionaires and very, very wealthy families that are known, you know, for their political activism. And there's probably two or three times that many who are, you know, very quiet in the background, but they're pouring, you know, they're flooding the zone with cash. And then there's, you know, a number of large corporations that toss in too, although they tend not to be quite as partisan as these individual billionaires.
Well,
I'm guessing it's probably fewer than 200 or 300 people in total.
You know, that's really stunning, isn't it? Who has control? Yeah, that own the country.
Yep. Yeah. Well, at least own the political system of the country. Yeah. And that's, you know, that is not what you call democracy.
You know, I wanted to make this group, this oligarchy, seem more real in their account as a couple of hundred people, but also to relate a couple of things of what they think of us. I just recently heard that a friend of Ivanka Trump's gave her a book, and Ivanka asked why should she be interested in reading it, because it was about poor people. You know, that, you know, really shows you the mental separation from the rest of the country. And I remember also several years ago, Jeff Green, who made billions on the subprime mortgages, flew his wife and children and two nannies on a private jet to Davos. But then he was quoted as saying, Americans' expectations were just too high, and they needed to adjust to having less things and a smaller, better existence. And I just find it, you know, these are real people, and what they think of us isn't very kind. So I guess it makes it justifies what they do. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a mindset. You know, I mean, these are people by and large who slightly fewer than half of all the billionaires in America inherited their money or married it. You know, they became billionaires the old-fashioned way. So, you know, never worked a day in their lives. They have a lower tax rate than you and I do. If you make your living and get a paycheck for the sweat of your brow or the work of your brain, you can pay a maximum 36% tax rate. If you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, you pay a maximum, I think it's 23% now, the capital gains rate. They dropped it substantially with the last Trump tax cut. So, you know, they've got their own rules. They've got their own tax rate. They have functionally their own criminal justice system. When they get busted, they go to a different kind of prison than the average person. When that rarely happens, it's a parallel world here in the United States.
Well, it almost seems like, I know we talk about two Americas, you know, there's the extreme right and what's happening with the Fox News viewers and Breitbart and OANN, and then there's the left side and a lot of independents. But it seems like there's a third America, which is the oligarch America, which is just a totally different reality as well.
Yes, and I don't think the average person can even imagine the kind of wealth we're talking about and the kind of insular lives that these folks live. You know, I know a few people in Hollywood, and I was visiting a friend of mine who's a movie star, and he has a chef, you know, who comes over and cooks his meals on some days, and we were just chatting with her, and my friend left the room to use the bathroom, and I said something to her about, you know, seems like a nice place to work here, and she said, oh, you wouldn't believe how great it is here. And she told me about royalty rules, which I had no idea about. In the British royal family, if you're visiting the Queen, for example, or if any of the help, the bottom line is, if any of the help establishes eye contact with any member of the royal family, they're immediately fired, like against the rules. And it turns out that there's several Hollywood stars, you know, who are big people who are very famous, who have the same set of rules in their houses. She said this is like normal among the billionaire class. Like, you know, the help is furniture. They are not human beings. And she was just kind of gushing about how my friend, the actor, was such a great human being and, you know, knew her and knew her kids and all this kind of stuff. And it's just like it's such a separate world. They travel in private jets. They never go through airport security. They never handle cash. It's almost unimaginable. Well, I think a lot of it is unimaginable for the average American.
What I try to do to relate it is that $1 billion. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tom. Is $1,000 million. So yep. If you have $5 billion, you have $5,000 million.
That's right.
Okay, and if you're Jeff Bezos with $140 billion, then you have $140,000 million. I mean,
that's correct.
It just gets to be to drive that home. Any one of us would like $1 million, let alone $1,000 million. And I feel I would be remiss if I didn't bring up what's been happening recently in race relations and the rise of, you know, really having a white supremacist president and what's happening with the white supremacy growing in this country. And how are the oligarchs using white supremacy, or are they?
Well, you can't get elected if your sales pitch is vote for me, I'm going to cut taxes on rich people and let corporations poison your air. You know, it's just not something that's going to get you elected. And so what the Republican Party has had to do over the years is bring in a coalition of people, basically single-issue voters, who will vote with them. From the time that Franklin Roosevelt took on the oligarchs in the 1930s until the late 1960s, you know, the Republican Party was basically out in the wilderness. Even Dwight Eisenhower governed as a Democrat. In fact, everybody speculated when he said that he was going to run for president in 1951. Everybody speculated he was going to run as a Democrat, but he ultimately decided to run as a Republican just, I think, for a practical reason, that he had a greater probability of not having a serious primary challenge there, because he had been in the military, which is totally apolitical. So basically, you know, the GOP was out of power. And other than one two-year period, the Republicans didn't control the House of Representatives from 1932 until the Newt Gingrich thing in, 1996? I mean, that's a massive amount of time. So what Richard Nixon came up with after the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were passed in 1965, 64 and 65, and then the Great Society Lyndon Johnson literally cutting poverty in half in America in a decade with his Great Society programs, Medicaid, Medicare, long-term unemployment insurance, housing assistance, food stamps, all these things came out of this little kind of five-year window in the Johnson administration. And so they just decided to go after them. And the Republican Party just, we have reached the point. I'm sorry, I got distracted. Something just popped up on my screen. I just totally lost my train of thought. Where was I going with that, Jill?
Well, you were talking about the Republican Party and where they are today, I think.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's like, you know, so what Nixon did is he reached, and thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I thought I had a virus alert or something. Suddenly I had this thing on my... Anyway, so Richard Nixon decided to reach out to the racists who were really upset with Lyndon Johnson having passed civil rights, you know, and ended legal apartheid in the United States, because we had had this legal doctrine of apartheid ever since the late 1890s. And that got blown up, with Brown v. Board in 54, and then it got put into law in 1965. So Nixon, with his Southern strategy, reached out to the racists. And, you know, that was enough to get him elected. But it really didn't hold for that well. So Reagan came along, and he had the business community, and he had the big advantage in 1980 when Reagan ran of having those two Supreme Court decisions that gave him enormous amounts of cash so he could fight the unions. But also, President Bonnie Sauter of Iran is on record, and I think this is in this book. If not, it's certainly in my book on the Supreme Court. President Bonnie Sauter said that, he ran in August of 1980 for president of Iran on a platform of freeing the hostages. Jimmy Carter, you know, the hostages have been taken in November or December of 1979. And pretty sure it was November. And it was really hurting Carter politically. We had this whole tie a yellow ribbon on the tree and all this kind of stuff, bring the hostages home, and Carter just couldn't make it happen. When he was elected president in August of 1980, he went to the Ayatollah Khomeini and said, okay, it's time to release the hostages. I got a 74%, I won the election by 74%. That all the candidates who were running on a platform of freeing the hostages totaled 91% of the vote in the 1980 election in Iran. And he said, so we got to free the hostages. And President Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini said, no, we cut a deal with the Reagan campaign. And in fact, you know, because we've got all these weapons that were made in the United States that they sold to the Shah of Iran, and our military is all American-made stuff, and we need spare parts, and we need missiles and stuff like that. And so we cut a deal with the Reagan administration that if we'll hold the hostages until after the election, then they will sell us weapons. And sure enough, that's what happened. And, you know, Bonnie Sauter wrote an op-ed about this in the Christian Science Monitor some, you know, about a decade and a half ago. And sure enough, that's what we call Iran-Contra. You know, I mean, he was selling weapons to Iran and then using the money from that, from those sales to fund right-wing death squads in Central America, which is why we're having all these Central American refugees on our southern doorstep right now because of how badly destabilized Central America was because of, as a consequence of Reagan's policies.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org homepage or listen later to Be Bold America's podcast now on 11 podcast platforms. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
This Sunday evening at 6, KSQD presents New Dimensions in a conversation with Reverend Jennifer Butler. Whether you're a Christian, a Jew, belong to any other denomination, or have no religious affiliation, you may be surprised to know that the Bible represents generations of faith communities who resisted tyranny when the future looked bleak. Reverend Butler offers a look at Scripture with new eyes to help us see what biblical stories have to say about the overall arc of Scripture as a call to resist tyranny. Here, she illuminates those unifying truths that are at the heart of so many traditions of faith and moral philosophy. That's New Dimensions, Sunday at 6 p.m. here at KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station.
Welcome back, and we're speaking with someone I consider a longtime mentor, having listened to him for more than 15 years, Tom Hartman. We're discussing his latest book, The Hidden History of American Oligarchy, Reclaiming Our Democracy from the Ruling Class. And Tom, before I ask you what you suggest listeners could keep doing, stop doing, and start doing in this last, you know, segment that we have together, I want, which is sort of like your, probably relates to your chapter about breaking oligarchy, restoring democracy. I just sort of frame it a little bit differently. But I wanted to ask you what your views regarding the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and what role the oligarchy played that led to the Republican insurrection against democracy.
Well, we're starting to find that some very wealthy people provided some substantial material funding to the conspiracy, for lack of a better word. And I'm hoping that a lot of this comes out during the trial of Donald Trump in the Senate, because if it is what we think it is, then it's really grim that this was an actual coup attempt, not just a crazed mob or a riot. It was an attempt to assassinate the vice president and the Speaker of the House and bring down the American government and install Donald Trump as a dictator for life. That's what it looks like to me. And there are some very wealthy people who would be just fine with that. In fact, I just last year read for the first time, I had lived in Germany back in the 80s, and I had read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, you know, William Scherer's book. But I got a copy, and actually I found it in my dad's collection, and my brother sent it to me after my dad died, a copy of Fritz Thyssen's book, Thyssen. He was the Thyssen Steel was the one of the largest German industries in the 1920s when Hitler was rising to power. And he wrote a book called I Paid Hitler. It's you can still find copies, you know, used copies on Amazon. And it was all about how all the big industrialists thought that Hitler was going to bring, because he was a strong man, it was a strong man government, he was going to crack down on the socialists and the communists, particularly the socialists and the trade unions. And that was, you know, the famous Pastor Niemöller quote, you know, first they came for the socialists and then they came for the trade unionists. He thought that it would be good for German industry. And so he funded Hitler. And, of course, his steel mills got just the bejesus bombed out of them in the war. And his autobiographical account is pretty filled with remorse. But, you know, when you look at the rise of oligarchic tyrants like that, whether it was Hitler or whether it was, you know, in Chile with, what's his name? In any case, you know, they're all around the world. I mean, you find case after case after case where basically the people behind them, you know, Bolsonaro in Brazil, you've got Viktor Orban in Hungary. As they're brought to power, they consolidate the rich people behind them. Certainly, we've seen this in the Stan countries, the former Soviet republics, and we're seeing it in Russia as well. You know, it shouldn't surprise anybody that the oligarchs would be fine with ending American democracy. But I still think Americans don't realize the gravity of what has happened.
I don't think so either. I heard about the funding and, you know, that it really appeared that it was well-funded and organized. And I heard Malcolm Nance say that very possibly was a murder cell, what he called a murder cell within that group. And the way we know how they were targeting Vice President Pence and Nancy Pelosi, I think he's probably correct. So, Tom, what could listeners keep doing, stop doing, start doing as it relates to being aware, fighting, stopping the oligarchs from destroying democracy completely?
Well, we need to get money out of politics. And, you know, the first piece of legislation that they're going to pass out of the House and they're going to try and bring up in the Senate, H.R. 1 and S.B. 1, is the For the People Act, which will limit the role of money in politics, which is like a really good thing. The problem, of course, is because it's not a budget bill, it's not an appropriation, it can't be passed via reconciliation. It has to, you know, it will be subject to filibuster. And I doubt that even one Republican will vote for it because, you know, the Republicans' political business model is take money from billionaires. So they're not going to, you know, bite the hand that feeds them. And I wish that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and probably a few others would get out of the way and go along with ending the filibuster, because this is just flat out nuts. You know, we've got a majority and we can't pass meaningful legislation.
Well, we're really at a moment, aren't we? I what would you say to those, because I've heard this from several people, that they're just tired of thinking about Donald Trump, the Republicans, the super rich, and they just want to move on. We're at a real moment. What would you say to them?
Well, the super rich are not done with us yet. we may think we're done with them, but there's still wealth in America to extract. There's still rebellion to put down. They need to pacify the populace. They think that they have a lot of work to do. And
so what specifically can, when they're not through with us, so we can't be through with them, what can listeners keep doing and stop doing and start doing?
Well, wake people up, spread the message, tell the stories about, you know, what's happened and the historical context of this, and be supportive of your political figures who are doing everything they can to change these circumstances. I would say probably the most critical thing right now that we can all be doing is calling every single member of the Senate. The number for Congress's switchboard is 202-224-3121. And you can ask for any senator and they'll connect you. And certainly call your own senators, but also call as many Republican senators as you can. As many of the conservative Democratic senators as you can, like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin in particular, and say, please end the filibuster. Let the Democrats govern. And, you know, because if we can't get money out of politics, if we can't overturn Citizens United, basically, if we can't bring America back from this brink that these insane right-wingers on the Supreme Court have set us up for, we may be facing some very, very dark days.
Well, in this last 2 minutes or so, what would that world look like if they actually, you know, third time's a charm? There might be this third time we're fighting the oligarchs with this modern oligarchy with their think tanks and the money that they have and the lies and the misinformation in the media. We didn't even get a chance to talk about the media oligarchy. And if they're successful, just, you know, a minute or two on what would that world look like for us? I'm sure women's rights over their own body would be gone. Unions would be gone. What else?
Yeah. Well, it would probably look like, you know, for an American analog, you know, look at the South in the 1850s. You know, a small number of very rich and powerful white men run the country. And, or, you know, look at Russia today, or look at Hungary. Actually, there's a chapter about how Viktor Orban pulled this off and all the details of what he did in Hungary in the book, in the Hidden History of American Oligarchy. And, you know, he turned all the media over to his friends. He helped them basically buy out and, all the radio and television stations, newspapers, even major websites. He turned over the oil infrastructure to his friends, the banking to his friend. Basically, anybody who wants to be a successful business person in Hungary right now has to be a friend of Viktor Orban's. And Trump was heading in that direction. He had several billionaires in his cabinet. He had Betsy DeVos trying to destroy public schools and privatize them. He had Wilbur Ross, who was the Secretary of Commerce, who Forbes magazine said was a grifter, mm-hmm. a professional grifter, mm-hmm. You know, in charge of the Department of Commerce, which oversees an awful lot of, you know, the Federal Trade Commission and all this other stuff, you know, like corporate activity in the United States. So, and you combine that with somebody like, you know, our former Attorney General, Bill Barr, being perfectly willing to use the police powers of the nation crush dissent. And, you know, you combine a police state with that, and you've got oligarchy becoming tyranny.
Thank you, Tom. You know, thank you for choosing Be Bold America. It was such an honor to be able to interview you on the hidden history of the American oligarchy. People, buy his book, buy the entire series. They're the civics course you never had. I want to thank Be Bold America. You're welcome. Thank you. I want to thank Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, KSQD's program director, Howard Feldstein, and give another big thank you to today's terrific and bold guest, Tom Hartman. You can hear Tom right here on KSQD at 4 p.m. weekdays. Next on Sunday, February 14th, it will be Be Bold America's second anniversary. And we'll be making a shift in direction and introducing a co-host. We aren't leaving politics behind. Our country is in desperate shape, and we're teetering towards fascism. Even the center of democracy, our Congress, has become a dangerous place. We have a crisis in politics that can't be ignored, but we have a crisis in citizen character and principle-centered living that can't be ignored either. I was shocked at how many Americans voted for Trump. The most unprincipled and characterless president of the United States of America we've ever had. I was even more shocked to realize that 1 million more people voted for him than did in 2016, after suffering through the last 4 years. On February 14th, I'll be introducing Dr. Pettus Perry, who will be joining me as co-host to talk about politics, social justice, and how the individual American could live a more meaningful and principle-centered life. Many years ago, Pettus and I taught an immensely popular university class called Creating a Meaningful Life. It was so popular that the provost capped the number of sections our department had because it was drawing too many students away from the other colleges. So we're going to pick that topic back up and see how we can apply it to our democracy. That's Sunday, February 14th at 5 p.m. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for new dimensions. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start,